Next time on Q, Brazilian bossa nova king Sergio Mendes has always combined traditional music of his home country with American influences. He talks to guest host Brent Bambury about his new album, Magic. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on KCPW.
KCPW's broadcasts of Q are funded in part by the Utah Film Center, building community through the power of film, online at utahfilmcenter.org.
It's time once again for Access Downtown. I'm Roger McDonough, joined by Jason Mathis of the Downtown Alliance. Jason, the Downtown Alliance is hosting the 2014 State of Downtown event on July 11th. What is this event all about?
Well, we're really excited about this. This is when we kind of report back to the community, how is our urban center doing? How's downtown doing? So we'll have some data about how retail is doing. We will look at residential development, at office space. A lot of quantitative data. We're also going to be talking about how downtown is being perceived right now. So we will release the results of a survey that was done across the state of how people are feeling about their downtown, what people are thinking about downtown, why they want to come downtown. And it's some really interesting data. We'll also unveil our 2014 Downtown Achievement Award winners, so people who have made a huge contribution to shaping our urban center in the last year.
And I understand also that author David Burstein is going to be there.
That is correct. David is the author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. And, you know, when we look at the research, millennials are really the group most interested in downtown. That's the group who want to live downtown, who are interested in working downtown, participating in the urban center. Often they don't want to have cars. They want to live close to where they work. It's a huge topic nationally. People are really trying to understand this generation. And David has written this book. He's an expert, and he will come in, talk about what this generation wants and how it fits with downtown Salt Lake City. So we're excited about that. So this is on July 11th, and it's held at the Leonardo. The event starts at 10 o'clock in the morning, and we'll go for about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, and then we're going to have a networking lunch, a very casual networking lunch after that. Tickets to attend this event are $50. People can find out more information on the Downtown Alliance website, which is downtownslc.org/tickets.
Great, Jason. Well, thanks again for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
This has been Access Downtown on KCPW.
The 23rd season of the Downtown Farmers Market is underway and continues every Saturday morning from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Historic Pioneer Park through October 25th. The market features more than 250 vendors offering local produce, meats, cheeses, and much more. Details are online at slcfarmersmarket.org. KCPW is a proud sponsor of the 2014 Salt Lake City Downtown Farmers Market.
And thanks again for tuning in to The Rundown. A little bit later on the show, University of Utah James Joyce scholar Vincent Chang on celebrating the novel Ulysses. First, though, these headlines. A group of former employees of the Salt Lake Tribune have filed a lawsuit to suspend the newspaper's joint operating agreement with the Deseret News, arguing that the terms violate federal antitrust laws and undermine the Tribune's independent voice. The 30-page lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court on Monday says the agreement that was revised in October gives too much control to the Deseret News, which is owned by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The group previously sent a letter asking the U.S. Justice Department to review the recently revised six-decade-old agreement between Salt Lake City's two daily newspapers. Under the revised agreement, the Deseret News bought the Tribune's share of a printing plant and will get 70% of the profits, up from 32% prior to the change. Since late last month, there's been a brouhaha over the Utah Division of Alcoholic Beverage Control. That's when the DABC Commission announced they were revisiting the intent of the statute regulating single-event liquor permits, putting events like Snowbird Ski Resort's Oktoberfest in a liquor limbo. On Monday, the state legislature's Administrative Rules Review Committee invited DABC officials, including Commissioner John Nielsen and Executive Director Sal Petilos, to explain why the change in the interpretation of the law was taking place. Nielsen and other DABC representatives explained that there was no change occurring, but that the regulatory body wanted to review how these single-event permits were being granted. Moreover, the DABC wants to ensure that no groups or individuals are making improper use of these one-time permits. After the hearing, Nielsen said he anticipated Oktoberfest would earn the permit it is seeking.
That will come before the commission in this month's hearing. Unfortunately, I will not be there. I'll be out of town. But I would anticipate that it would be approved.
Based on?
Based upon my view. Now, I'm only one of several, but if I were there, I would vote to approve it.
During the hearing, members of the legislative committee expressed interest in revisiting the state's alcohol laws in order to make them less confusing. Lawmakers were concerned that a similar flap with the DABC would be embarrassing for Utah and could perhaps even hurt tourism. And that does it for a summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back.
This is Jim DeBacchus. Join me, Natalie Gochner in the middle and Greg Hughes on the right for Both Sides of the Aisle, Thursday mornings at 10:30 a.m. right here on KCPW.
Welcome back to The Rundown. If you're listening to the program right now, there's a chance you've got the TV on with the volume down. That's because the U.S. men's national soccer team is currently doing battle with the mighty soccer power Ghana. Yes, Ghana. Here's KCPW's Ryan Cunningham with Real Salt Lake blogger Matt Montgomery to give you your daily World Cup update.
All right, so this is an important day for United States soccer fans, but there were a lot of games over the weekend, so let's get some of the scores out of the way. Colombia beat Greece 3-0. Uruguay beat Costa Rica 3-1. England lost to Italy 2-1. And Ivory Coast beat Japan 2-1. That was all on Saturday. On Sunday, Switzerland beat Ecuador 2-1. France beat Honduras 3-0. And Argentina pulled out a victory over Bosnia 2-1.
Overall, it was an exciting weekend because there were just goals everywhere. Just goals everywhere to be found.
A lot of goals. There was one game, though, today that there were no goals.
First time in the tournament.
Iran and Nigeria had a 0-0 draw. Also, in the same group that the United States is playing in, there was a game between Germany and Portugal. Portugal lost 4-0 to Germany. Is that good news or bad news for U.S. fans?
That's a great question, and I don't think anyone really knows the answer yet. Obviously, if we're going to tie with Portugal on points at any point, having a better goal differential than them will benefit us. You know, going down 4 goals to Germany, while not totally unexpected, was a little surprising. Germany showing why they're one of the top teams in the world right now.
Okay, we can't really talk about the U.S. game because it's going on right now as this airs. So I thought we'd talk about maybe the history between U.S. and Ghana. Ghana has dominated against the U.S.
Yeah, in the 2 games we've played them since, I believe it's the 1980s, they've beat us just pretty handily, and it's a little distressing. Their striker, who scored a hat-trick last time, is out there again today. So there's a lot of bad blood between these two teams, not really the nations.
Well, we might have an entirely different story to tell tomorrow. We'll see.
I certainly hope so.
Sad or happy, we'll see. Thanks, Matt Montgomery, for coming in again today, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Yep, sounds great.
And again, that was KCPW's Ryan Cunningham with Matt Montgomery, who writes about Real Salt Lake at rslsoapbox.com. You can also follow Matt on Twitter at the handle TheCrossbarRSL. I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back.
This is Brian Dobson with Classic Optical, gratified local supporters of KCPW's community news, programming, and personalities. Classic Optical offers complete eye care, eye exams, custom lens design, and personalized frame fitting, including ski goggles and cycling glasses. More information can be found at classicoptical.net.
Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, something a little unusual. We're talking about a fictional day in history or a historic day in fiction, depending upon how you look at it. Bloomsday is a celebration of the novel Ulysses, its author James Joyce, and one day in the life of its central character, Leopold Bloom. The book sits atop several notable lists of the greatest novels of all time and is so packed full of puns and mysteries and hidden literary and linguistic references that James Joyce himself said that it would keep the professors busy for centuries, arguing over what he meant. A century after James Joyce started writing the novel, we're going to speak with one professor who has done a lot to elucidate Joyce's most famous work. Vincent Chang is a professor of English at the University of Utah and the author of several books and nearly countless papers touching on the works of James Joyce. Dr. Chang regularly teaches a course on Ulysses and Joyce and just completed a stint as the Carol and Gordon Siegel Distinguished Visiting Chair in Irish Literature at Northwestern University After he leaves the studio today, Dr. Chain, as he does every year, will head to the James Joyce Symposium, which Joyce scholars hold around this time annually. Dr. Chain, so much more I could add here, but I'll just say thanks for taking the time today.
It's my pleasure to be here, Roger.
So Bloomsday, June 16th, is the annual celebration of James Joyce's Ulysses. The book takes place over the course of an entire Dublin day, June 16th, 1904, morning to late night. Admirers of Joyce and his work have literary celebrations annually now. I thought it might make sense to kick things off by getting a taste of the Bloom in Bloomsday. Who, for our listeners, is Leopold Bloom?
Well, Joyce decided to make his modern epic, the hero of his modern epic, a common everyday person in Dublin, but also uncommon in that he's both an Irishman and a Jew. He's sort of bullied, persecuted, picked on by other Irishmen during the course of the day who think he's kind of weird because he's Jewish. And Joyce wrote Ulysses while he was living in Trieste and Paris and Zurich and met many Jews at a time when Europe, as we all know, early in the 20th century was really incredibly anti-Semitic. And so he always felt that anti-Semitism was a sure sign of ignorance, and he chose for his hero, Leopold Bloom, a Jewish Irishman, a businessman, an advertising salesman for the newspapers, trying to make his way through a typical, I think it was a Thursday, June 16th, 1904. And the novel follows his walks and wanderings around the city from a morning till late at night that day.
You know, and for much of the novel, where the reader is in the head of Bloom as he moves about his day, we get to hear his kind of disjointed, you know, sometimes very poignant, even mundane thoughts. Was this revolutionary at the time in terms of the novel form?
Absolutely. Joyce pioneered a new style of writing that we now tend to call stream of consciousness, which tried to replicate on paper what he felt was the closest thing to sort of, if it's possible, a transcript of what goes on in one's mind. So what that means is, first of all, we could read two paragraphs of sort of mental connections going on in Bloom's mind that actually would take place in a half second of actual elapsed time, just as our neurons and synapses fire and we think all these things at the same time. So in some ways, it's totally revolutionary because it doesn't depend on an outside narrative action and a sort of sequence of events, but just the sort of the consciousness going on of one's own interiority. There are many things one could say about this technique, but the other thing I want to start with is that it's also a technique that got the book banned, because if you're going to be serious about sort of recording on paper what people often think things that they would never say out loud, some of which is only semi-conscious, some of it which is repressed. Often it's very sexually frank or even, one might say, pornographic. And so if you're going to be serious about recording somebody's inner consciousness, the level of an expurgated frankness in fiction really ratchets up. And as a result of its especially sexual content and frankness, the book for decades was banned in both England and America. And many American artists and intellectuals, Faulkner, for example, had to go to Paris to buy a copy.
Right. And there was an entire market in sort of bootlegged Ulysses copies in the United States.
Absolutely.
Right?
You had to sort of smuggle one in a brown paper bag and hope the customs people didn't confiscate it. And ironically, for decades, the Irish refused to read it because Joyce was quite realistic about Ireland, both its strengths and weaknesses, and critical of both its ideologies and the church, as well as critical of the British. But Irish folks for decades told their children, don't you ever read anything by that dirty writer James Joyce. He says terrible things about us.
And in some ways, he was thought to be, I mean, and probably very much was, blasphemous in the sense of being critical of the power structure of the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland at the time.
Absolutely. Now, it's kind of odd to read Joyce now in the context of contemporary Ireland, where very few of the young people go to church anymore. The landscape of the post-Celtic Tiger Ireland, even though they're now going back into economic woes, but has changed a lot, so that a lot of the pubs used to be a pub and a church on every corner. A lot of the pubs have now been replaced by upscale restaurants and wine bars, and a lot of the churches are gone. And so many Irish people used to become nuns and priests. Now they have to import them from the Philippines to serve mass for the aging population. So few young Irish people go to church anymore that an Irish scholar friend of mine quipped recently that in the future, everybody's going to have to read Ulysses to find out what Irish Catholicism really was all about.
The modern population in Dublin is a bit removed from what Joyce is representing. You mentioned something, which is that Bloom is very much an outcast in the novel. He's Jewish in Roman Catholic Ireland, but he's no less Irish than the rest of the characters, though he's definitely seen as maybe un-Irish by the other characters that he encounters. This is something that you've written quite a bit about, Joyce's exploration of nationality, identity, race. Joyce was trying to hold up a mirror to the Irish people, you said.
Yes, and this issue particularly of who belongs in Ireland, the issue of nationness. I mean, Bloom was born in Ireland. You know, it's funny because I said Bloom was born in Ireland. We talk about Bloom as if he was a real person. Half the characters, or a good number of the characters in Ulysses, were actual people in Ireland at the time. Bloom is a fictional creation. But the main characters, Bloom, Stephen Dedalus, and Bloom's wife, Molly, are so real because we plumb the depths of their consciousness so much that in some ways it feels like we know these characters as well as any characters in fiction, that we talk about them as if they were real people and celebrate what is now called Bloom's Day each year as if it was a real anniversary. But this issue of sort of, you know, who belongs in the Irish nation, of course in 1904 Ireland was not a nation yet, was still part of the British Empire, but there was this feeling that with the growing Irish nationalist movement, the independence movement, the growth of the nascent movement of Sinn Féin at the time, there was a sort of hierarchy of who could be considered Irish. You needed to be Irish-born, Catholic, hopefully Gaelic-speaking, of Gaelic roots, which of course cut out a lot of people, including Irish Protestants like Yeats and Synge, as well as characters like Bloom. And Bloom has this sort of moving moment later in the novel in the Cyclops episode where all these drunken men are kind of picking on him. And one of them says, "Do you even know what a nation means?" And he responds by, you know, he doesn't know how to answer the question. So he says, "Well, a nation is the same people living in the same place." And they all laugh and make fun of him. And one of them says, "Well, if that's what a nation is, then I'm a nation because I've been living in the same place for 5 years." And Bloom then tries to muck out of it by saying, "Or also in different places." And they laugh and make fun of him again. But I point out that in some ways those answers are actually, I think, things that, although Bloom is being made fun of, Joyce kind of believed in, a nation as either the same people living in the same place or also in different places, because it's a definition that refuses to sort of exclude anybody within the nation state, that we all belong in the community. And in an odd way, Bloom's statement prefigures the weird logic of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 that finally looks like it's bringing the possibility of peace to Northern Ireland, because the Good Friday Agreement basically argues that you can be living in Northern Ireland and choose to become either a citizen of the Republic of Ireland in the south, where you're not living, right, or of the UK, of a British citizen, where you're also not living, or both at the same time. It's a kind of mind-blowing concept that completely unmoors nationality and citizenship from the usual requirements.
It's a very modern idea, this idea that national identity isn't, you know, there's a lot to be said about immigration, for example, in our own country or around the world these days. What makes a passport holder versus, you know, somebody who is culturally from a place? It's a fascinating exploration that Joyce was doing well ahead of his time, I think, right?
Absolutely. In a lot of ways, because the literary techniques and the kind of avant-garde nature of the text was so striking that for decades, scholars and readers tended to read that as Joyce's main achievement, and largely it, because most of the scholars at the time were British and American and continental, since Irish people didn't read Joyce, we tended to ignore until the last couple of decades the issue of Joyce's both political and ideological views and the comments he makes about Irish identity and citizenship and nationality and British imperialism and so forth.
Just a reminder to our listeners that I'm speaking with Dr. Vincent Chang, a professor of English at the University of Utah and a scholar, if you haven't guessed yet, of the Irish writer James Joyce. Okay, we're getting a little removed from the celebration of this book every year on today, on Bloomsday, June 16th. When did readers or scholars or whoever it was first start celebrating this day? Or let's start with that. When did Bloomsday become a thing?
The novel came out in 1922, but it's about June 16th, 1904. June 16th, 1904 was not an accidentally chosen date. It was, in some ways, we think of Joyce as such a sort of realist skeptic, but there's a real romantic impulse, a sentimental impulse behind this, because June 16th, 1904 was the date of Joyce's first date with his future wife, Nora, when they went out walking together in Dublin. And he, in some ways, wanted to commemorate the first time they spent time together. She would, of course, be his lifelong companion. And the day, in some ways, it's an uneventful day, but Joyce tries to replicate, in some ways, he gives us what's going on in the minds of his main characters. But in the course, he replicates what was actually going on in that day. He read all the newspapers, knew, for example, at 8 in the morning, or is it 10 in the morning, I can't remember, a three-masted ship, the Roseveen, sailed into Dublin Harbor. Joyce has Stephen Dedalus turning around and noticing a three-masted ship sailing in at that point. It was the day the most important horse race in the British Isles, the Ascot Gold Cup, was run that day, that year. And who ran in the Gold Cup becomes an important theme in the novel, because the men put their money on the favorite scepter, and it turns out to be the 20-to-1 dark horse throwaway who wins, as was true on June 16, 1904. And Bloom himself is sort of made out to be a dark horse and a throwaway. There are all sorts of other little details, of realistic details, that Joyce tried to replicate in the course of these 24 hours. And so it seems so real in some ways, as if it was a day that actually happened in people's memory, that people started commemorating Bloomsday. Now, I think the actual first real commemoration was at the 50th anniversary of Bloomsday on June 16, 1954, in which the great Irish comic writer Flann O'Brien talked his pub-owning friend John Ryan into organizing a small group of Irish literati, and they rented a couple of horse-drawn cabs and try to basically, hour by hour, go through Bloom's day and stop at every pub Bloom does and so forth. They didn't make it through the evening because they got so drunk that finally they all adjourned to Bailey's, which was John Ryan's pub, arguing with themselves and deciding that they were too drunk to continue the rest of the day. But Ulysses has really become such an iconic text for so many people, not just academics, but so many people who read it in college, as English majors, as graduate students, who are fans of it, that we have Bloomsday celebrations all over the world. And I'm always sort of, in some ways, sad. I often miss the Bloomsday celebrations in my own home cities, because I'm at the symposia celebrating with other Joyceans. And the celebrations are often hilarious. They, of course, always center around a pub with lots of Guinness, but they're often performances, reproductions of scenes from the novel. The most elaborate ones, of course, tend to take place in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And this is true of both sort of the academic symposia and local celebrations. I mean, the largest one probably was the 2004 celebration, which was the 100th.
Fictional 100-year, and I mean, because it's commemorating 100 years since the day actually took place, even though it was written some 18 years later, or
right,
finished written.
Right, and it became a huge tourist attraction in Ireland, because on the one hand, there were the usual 200 or 300 academics who were giving talks at the conference venue, but the city was swamped with thousands of both Irish people and tourists coming for the 100th celebration. That included, for example, on Bloomsday morning, June 16th, where in the actual novel, Leopold Bloom makes himself a pork kidney for breakfast, goes and buys one and then makes one. Well, they had lined the central area of Dublin and O'Connell Street and with thousands of tables where for a small amount of money, you could have a Bloomian breakfast. And this was a populist event. Yes, I was there, but there were thousands of people who were clearly not, half of whom had probably not read Ulysses, participating in a Bloomsday breakfast. And then later, and in various events during the day where various scenes were replicated on the street, it was quite something.
A massive and enormous event.
You were there, right?
I was there. I got to witness some of this, and I did partake in the Bloomsday breakfast. You know, I'm just thinking of the amount of time that we have here, and we've been talking about kind of the traditional celebration, or you know, what now people do to celebrate Bloomsday. And you mentioned something, which is that a great number of people who probably participate in these events, but probably a great many people who even own the book, haven't read the book. And I'm wondering if you have advice for people who haven't read the book on how they might actually approach Ulysses, which is hailed as one of the greatest novels of all time.
That's a tough one because I get asked that by students all the time, as well as friends. And my answer is that if you're a smart and good reader, you can get into it. It helps that there is a book on the market called the Bloomsday Book, which is a kind of chapter-by-chapter summary, which helps in terms of a first reading of Ulysses. Mm-hmm. But most people, even if they're good readers, have a hard time getting through the book by themselves because there are so many things in each episode that are hard to understand without a kind of context. And so what I really say to most people, especially students, is if you get a chance, take a course on Joyce where you can, the first time around, read it with help, with criticism, with a teacher's lectures and stuff, because this is a book to keep rereading. Any first reading, even within a course, you only get maybe a tenth of everything that's there, and nobody gets everything, ever.
Right.
You know, Ulysses has a kind of intimidation factor for a lot of readers, that they think this is a difficult book. I always say to my students, don't be intimidated. Joyce thought of this as a comic book. He thought of this as a comic novel. He spent hours in the back room. Nora would tell stories about him writing in the back room, just laughing out loud as he was writing. This is a book that's both funny and moving and, of course, sex-filled, but we won't go into that here. And it's really fun to read, and people shouldn't be intimidated by it.
Dr. Vincent Chang is a professor of English at the University of Utah, the author of numerous works examining the writings of James Joyce. Thank you once again for coming in and helping us get a handle on this.
This is a lot of fun. Thank you, Roger.
And there is much more to this conversation. I spoke with Dr. Chang about James Joyce's own story, about the novel's other main characters, Stephen Dedalus and Molly Bloom. If you're interested, you can find a full version at our website, kcpw.org. And it's time now for the Utah Business Report, where we check stocks of local interest and the top movers for the day, funded by Nathan Smart and Daryl Trost of Wells Fargo Advisors. There's time to check on just a couple of stocks today. The Williams Companies Incorporated shot up 18.75% to $56.02 after the pipeline operator said it would acquire Access Midstream Partners in a nearly $6 billion deal. Meanwhile, SkyWest Airlines faltered slightly today, dipping 2.77% to $11.60. That's the Utah Business Report. Stay tuned for Marketplace here on KCPW.
KCPW's Utah Business Report is sponsored by Nathan Smart and Daryl Trost, financial advisors with Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC in Salt Lake City. For over 20 years, they've helped simplify the complex process of planning for lifetime income. Information at 801-484-PLAN. With you to help plan your financial future.
Support for KCPW programming comes from the following local businesses. From Avenue's Pet Clinic, medical and dental services for dogs, cats, and small pets at 350 East, 100 South. From Nobrow Coffee Works, on the corner of 200 West and 900 South, or nobrowcoffee.com. And from A Gallery, Studio A and Frames Incorporated, 1321 South, 2100 East, and agalleryonline.com.